Take your Bible, please, in hand if you have it, or noting the screen before you. I would like you to follow along as I read from Genesis chapter 6, beginning at verse 9. Genesis 6, verse 9. This is the account of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, blameless among the people of his time, and he walked with God. Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight and was full of violence. God saw how corrupt the earth had become, for all the people on earth had corrupted their ways. So God said to Noah, I am going to put an end to all people, for the earth is filled with violence because of them. I am surely going to destroy both them and the earth. So make yourself an ark of cypress wood. Make rooms in it and coat it with pitch inside and out. This is how you are to build it. The ark is to be 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, and 45 feet high. Make a roof for it and finish the ark to within 18 inches of the top. Put a door in the side of the ark and make lower, middle, and upper decks. I'm going to bring floodwaters on the earth to destroy all life under the heavens, every creature that has the breath of life in it. Everything on earth will perish. But I will establish my covenant with you, and you will enter the ark, you and your sons and your wife and your sons' wives with you. You are to bring into the ark two of all living creatures, male and female, to keep them alive with you. Two of every kind of bird, of every kind of animal, and of every kind of creature that moves along the ground will come to you to be kept alive. You are to take every kind of food that is to be eaten and store it away as food for you and for them. Noah did everything just as God commanded him. You may be seated. It is, I suppose, somewhat presumptuous of me to comment on a motion picture that I have not seen, but presumptuous I will be. I understand that the film is called The Prince of Egypt, and it is the movie studio version of the life of Moses. Now, what I've heard about the film is very positive. It is reported that while it misses on some of the facts of the story, it is largely a portrayal, a good portrayal, of a very important time in human life. While I was studying the passage that we have just read and the text that follows it as well, the text for today, the Genesis flood, I wondered how a motion picture might depict this story. If Disney or the DreamWorks studios or Spielberg or Katzenberg were to bring this to the large screen, what would it look like? Maybe more precisely, I was asking, how would the screenwriter describe this event? What would they choose to tell? Well, Moses was the screenwriter, so to say, the writer of this story. And I think it's very instructive to us to know what it was that he chose out of that story that it had been handed down orally for so many years to declare to the Israelites so many years later. Most stories told well begin by introducing the characters, and then very quickly they settle or they raise some kind of issue, some dilemma, some problem for us to consider. Usually the story progresses from that point as the problem gets worse. Then when all hope seems lost, finally a solution emerges. And then the story closes with something of an epilogue where some of the loose ends are finally tied up. Like the best stories, this one in Genesis is also true. Or like they say in the movies, the story you are about to see is based on actual events. The story begins with the 9th verse of chapter 6 of Genesis. It tells us about this man named Noah, a good man, approved by God, liked by his peers, and he had three sons. Now, when you start that way, it doesn't seem to be saying much yet. It simply introduces the man. That is, it doesn't say much until immediately you are put in mind of the kind of society in which he lived. For the story goes on to tell us more about Noah, but it does so by showing him in contrast to the world around him. And so what we find very early in Genesis 6 is this man, Noah, a good man, living among a very evil people. But even that does not seem like much of a story until we come to the next scene. That is, to know that there's a good man living in an evil world is a story that probably could be repeated and retold many times the world over. What is so unique about this? The next scene tells us. God says, I'm going to put an end to all people, for the earth is filled with violence because of them. I am surely going to destroy both them and the earth. Now we have a plot. Now we wonder what is going to happen. How will the threat be carried out? Is this the end of the human race? Will anyone survive? God commands Noah to build an ark, a floating zoo, to protect Noah, his family, and the animals that will begin life again after the flood. And at that point, I think the tension begins to mount, because while Noah builds, no one else believes that a flood is going to come. You can imagine trying to convince people that there is a bomb in your building only to have them treat you as if you are naive at best or insane at worst. But in spite of the way that Noah is ignored or ridiculed, he does exactly as the Lord commands. 120 years he obeys. We're rather captured, I think, by the development of the character Noah during this time. His efforts at warning others seem noble, even if they are fruitless. And then it happens. All heaven breaks loose. What was predicted happens. The worst occurs. The earth erupts, the clouds rupture, and the water pours out as it never had before and never would again. Hurricane Mitch, the floods of China or Sioux Falls, the latest tsunami, all of those together don't begin to compare with the devastation that is brought about by this flood described in Genesis chapter 6. I think with me you could easily imagine how a motion picture would depict it. The crashing sounds, the waves of water, the desperate actions of people in cities and villages and farms. The scenes would move from New York City to Calcutta to a village in Peru to a man walking on a street in Japan, and you would see it before your very eyes on the screen as this flood overwhelms everything. The sound is absolutely deafening, and then silence. That eerie silence that comes after the most devastating events. That kind of silence that accompanies death. And the text says every living thing on the face of the earth was wiped out. But the story isn't over. Even as our eyes observe the destruction through those panning cameras, our minds remember the ark. What happened to them? Did they survive? Will they make it? And we sense some relief as we notice that a wind has picked up, the rains have stopped, the sun has begun to come out, and it appears as though the waters might be receding. And then as Moses tells the story, we move inside the ark. We were wondering what happened to them. We wondered if it was all over, but it's not. We move in the ark and we see a rather anxious Noah wondering still how they will be saved. He sends out a bird, or birds actually, to see if they could find land. One just flies around, not landing anywhere. Another returns, finding nothing. And then a dove returns with an olive leaf in its mouth, indicating that the ground has reappeared. And finally, after a year, Noah throws off the covering, and he sees dry ground. And at God's command, they leave the boat. And again, I can imagine in my own mind's eye the kind of scene before us as Noah and the others set foot on terra firma. The sheer joy they must have experienced and expressed as they walked about on solid ground. Then imagine as they released the animals. If you have ever seen animals released from long confinement, you know what they do. The running and the jumping about of these animals. The sheer joy of it all. The story is nearly over, but you have an epilogue. And in the epilogue, Noah builds an altar. And there he expresses from his full heart his gratitude to God for what God has done in saving him, his family, and for that matter, creation itself. And God himself responds. God makes a covenant that he had promised even before the flood began, a covenant with Noah, a covenant with all humanity, that God would never again flood the whole earth. And God tells Noah to look into the sky. And there Noah sees something he'd probably seen many times before. It's a rainbow. But God says, I want you to mark it down that rainbow is now a symbol of my covenant with you. Now that's the story. Again, I can imagine how it might be depicted in motion picture. But why the story? Moses, the master storyteller, I think, does it as it should be told. He begins by stating the dilemma, the problem builds, and finally there is resolution in an epilogue. But why does he tell the story? I think to answer that, we must first ask, who are the main characters? Who are they? Well, certainly Noah. But who besides Noah? God. God is clearly a main character in the text, but who else? Now, this one is a little odd, I confess, but I really think that the rest of the human race forms a character of sorts for the story. At least it's the foil against which the rest of the story is told. So the main characters are humanity, God, and Noah. But again, why tell the story? There are three themes that jump out at me as I read and reread this story. And interestingly enough, the three themes correspond to the three main characters. The first theme is judgment. Now, in addition to what the text itself says in Genesis chapter 6, I also know that I'm on solid ground when I say judgment is what Moses has in mind to talk about when I read what Peter says about this text. Talking about the judgment that is yet to come when Jesus returns again, this is what Peter said in 2 Peter 3. First of all, you must understand that in the last days, scoffers will come, scoffing and following their own evil desires. They will say, "Where is the coming he promised? Ever since our fathers died, everything goes on as it has since the beginning of creation." But Peter writes, "They deliberately forget that long ago, by God's word, the heavens existed, and the earth was formed out of water and by water. By these waters also, the world of that time was deluged and destroyed. By that same word, that is the word of God, the present heavens and earth are reserved for fire, being kept for the day of judgment and destruction of ungodly men." Last week's message from the early part of the sixth chapter of Genesis really focused on why judgment was necessary. Necessary because of the wickedness of every human being. Moses wanted his readers then, and I believe readers today, to be struck with the certainty of judgment. Peter said people forget. They forget that judgment did come for certain and that judgment will come again. Jesus said, Peter, ignore the idea of judgment. Speaking of his own coming and the judgment that would befall the earth at that time, Jesus said these words, "As it was in the days of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. For in the days before the flood, people were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, up to the day Noah entered the ark, and they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them all away. That is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man." Judgment that is coming is clearly a theme that Moses has in mind. He's not simply telling the Israelites about their history. He's telling them about their history because he wants them to know that the thing that was true then will be true in the future as well. Old Testament scholar Ron Youngblood, in an essay on judgment, said this of God's judgment. "God's judgment is not arbitrary. That is, God is not whimsical about this. Divine judgment is always related to human wickedness. In Genesis, we are told explicitly why God caused the flood. God said to Noah, 'I am going to put an end to all people, for the earth is filled with violence because of them.'" Filled with violence. A few years ago, not that many, Lance Morrow, an editorialist with Time magazine, wrote a piece on the evil that exists in the world. Using the normally upbeat and cheerful former Today weatherman Willard Scott in his piece, he suggested that I think there should be a dark Willard. In the network studio in New York City, dark Willard would recite the morning's evil report. The map of the world behind him would be a multicolored projection. Some parts of the earth where overnight good prevailed would glow with a bright transparency. But much of the map would be speckled and blotched. Over third world and first world, over cities and plains and miserable islands would be smudges of evil, ragged blights, storm systems of massacre or famine, murders, black snows, here and there a genocide, a true abyss. "Homo homini lupus," Dark Willard would remark. "That's Latin, guys. Man is a wolf to man." Dark Willard would add up the moral evils, the horrors accomplished overnight by man and woman. Anything new among the suffering Kurds? How about among the Central American death squads? New hackings in South Africa? Updating on the father who set fire to his 8-year-old son? How about the man in Georgia who kept his wife imprisoned for 30 years? Or the man who shook his baby until it ruined its brains? Or the starvation in Sudan, the infant mortality in Calcutta? Whether it was before the flood, then, or now, the truth is the same. Man's inhumanity to man runs nearly unabated. A wickedness exists on the earth that does deserve the judgment of God. And the point that Moses is making in retelling the story, and the point made for us that the judgment for sin now is as certain as was the flood. Judgment will come. Ron Youngblood went on to say that God's judgment is always announced. God always warns. In 2 Peter chapter 2, Peter speaks of Noah as a preacher of righteousness, one who by his very proclamation and by his life was condemning the people of his day. The New Testament is filled with such warnings. The Bible could not be clearer that judgment is coming. You'd have to distort the entire Bible in order to avoid the obvious warning. And God always warns. We live in that day of warning. God's judgment, thirdly, is preceded by a time for repentance. God waited 120 years before the flood came. We've had nearly 2,000 years since Jesus Christ lived and died and rose again. Nearly 2,000 years for people to get the message and turn to God, knowing that this is the day of salvation. Fourthly, Youngblood reminds us judgment always results in death. Paul wrote, "The wages of sin is death." As I read the story in Genesis, I was impressed of how much emphasis Moses places on the rising floodwaters. If you would read the text yourself, chapters 6, 7, and 8, you too would find it. Over and over and over again, he talks about how the waters covered, how high they rose, how great they were. 5 times in chapter 7 alone, he stresses that issue. And then he concludes with, "Every living thing that moved on the earth perished." Judgment kills. And judgment is coming. But the story of Noah and the flood is not only a lesson on judgment, it's also a lesson on grace. Without a doubt, God is a major character in the story. And though God is also the God of judgment, this story could have ended far earlier if that's all God was or is. And what is striking to me is that in the midst of this story and in the midst of a world of evil, God would choose to save anyone. That is the marvel of the story. When it says that Noah found grace or favor in the eyes of the Lord, that is not an indication that Noah in any way earned God's grace. Noah at the time had a heart that at its root was as corrupt as anyone else's, but Noah believed God. I'll speak more of Noah in just a minute. What I want you to see is that in the midst of judgment, God reached out to save a man and to save a race. The human race. Not only did God look with favor on Noah, but in the very midst of the flood, the very midst of the judgment, chapter 8, verse 1, it says that God remembered Noah. God showed his grace to him. Then after the flood, the very initiation of the covenant with Noah was yet another expression of God's grace and God's promise, giving human beings even more time, yet another opportunity to respond to God. God had every reason to end the entire world, for it to be lost, for it to be done with. But what I find so striking, as do many commentators, is the similarity between Genesis 6, 7, and 8 and Genesis 1 and 2. In Genesis 1 and 2, God creates this world. In Genesis 6 through 9, God is recreating. And as the world was originally formed out of the chaos of the water, so again, here in Genesis 6 through 9, it is out of the chaos of the water that dry ground again appears. As God first created plants and animal life to be a part of this earth, so in Genesis 6 through 9, God preserves the animals so that again, they can be a part of his creation. God was doing a new thing in place of the old world that was so corrupted. And so in the midst of judgment, God was saving. And to the man or woman like Noah who will believe God, who will reach out to God, God will save him. As Moses told this story to the Israelites, I think that Moses could assume that they would get the point, that they were now God's new thing. And Peter in the New Testament would make the same point, that we are now God's new thing, God's new creation. And so right in the midst of judgment, there was also to those who believed grace, immense grace. But I want you to see a third and a final theme in the story. It's the theme of faith. And I say that this is a major theme that Moses wants to point out, again, because of what the New Testament says. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 7. By faith, Noah, when warned about things not yet seen, in holy fear built an ark to save his family. By his faith, he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness that comes by faith. I wonder this morning, can you identify with Noah's faith? Can you imagine yourself what it would have been like, and what if it had been you? Charles Spurgeon, commenting on this Hebrews 11 passage, truly stands in awe of Noah and his faith. He wrote that Noah believed God in the ordinary things of life. He believed God in the warnings and threatening of God. He believed God in the improbable, if not the impossible. He believed God even though he was alone in his faith, and he believed God even though he waited 120 years. There's a phrase that I'm certain you have picked up on many times in the past in Genesis chapter 6, verse 9. It is that Noah walked with God. Noah was a man who lived with an awareness of the presence of God in his life. Noah was a man who lived in obedience to God in the everyday things of life. What this term walked with God indicates is that Noah was a man who walked with God in the ordinary stuff of life. He wasn't a man who had faith only in the crises of life. He was a man who lived it out day by day by day in the smallest things. I wonder, what does that look like for us? It was Noah's habit. It was simply part of who he was to walk with God. Noah believed God. He believed God when God warned that there would be a flood. A Spurgeon is the one who said, men do not prepare an ark to escape from a flood unless they believe there will be a flood. I find it almost incredible to believe Noah. I find it almost impossible to believe that a man could believe as Noah believed. Martin Luther said of the birth of Christ that the greatest miracle was not the incarnation. The greatest miracle was that Mary believed. And I feel that way about Noah. The greatest miracle was not the flood. The greatest miracle was that Noah believed God. Do you believe God when the only thing you have is his word for it? Maybe even when all other evidence points in the other direction? Do we believe him? Noah believed the warning of God's judgment. Thirdly, Noah believed God when no one else was buying it. Imagine working 120 years on a project that every person around you said was naive, if not crazy. How does a Muslim man in Sudan go against everything that his family stands for and trust in Jesus Christ? How does a woman become a Christian when every member of her family says that she must have lost her mind to believe such things? What does it mean to believe God when you're the only one? Noah's faith was in God, not in popular opinion. But maybe most importantly, I want you to see that Noah's faith was very active. Look again at the Hebrews 11 passage. By faith Noah, when warned about things not yet seen, in holy fear, built an ark to save his family. By his faith, he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness that comes by faith. Four times in this text, it says of Noah, he did everything just as God commanded him. Just this past week, the men's group of which I'm a part, was studying from James chapter 2, the latter half of that chapter. In that text, James doesn't use Noah as an illustration. He could have, but James makes this point. Faith without deeds is dead. Faith that does not result in a response of obedience to God is not genuine faith. Noah obeyed God exactly and carefully. Look at the construction of the ark. The detail of the building of the ark, the detail about the collection of the animals, is not just to satisfy our curiosity about how it might have happened. I believe the detail is given to demonstrate how carefully, how very exactly Noah obeyed God. Here's what Moses said to the Israelites in a different place, but to the same people that he wrote this story. When you and your children return to the Lord your God and obey him with all your heart and with all your soul, according to all I command you today, the Lord your God will restore your captivity and have compassion on you and gather you again from all the nations where he has scattered you. That is, when you obey God with all your heart and with all your soul. I believe that what the text shares with us is that Noah was such a man that with his whole heart, into the very details of life, that man obeyed God. He obeyed him at all costs. He obeyed him in spite of the opposition. His religion was not a Sabbath or Sunday experience only. His religion was not private. His religion was not simply something he believed in his head. Noah walked with God. A daily, dynamic, obedient, active faith. What did Moses want his readers to learn? About judgment. He wanted them to learn about grace. He wanted them to learn about faith. He wanted them to learn about the certainty and the severity of judgment that is yet to come. He wanted them to learn about the wonder and availability of grace. And he wanted them to know of the necessity and the character of true faith. Judgment is coming. God has said so. Grace is extended to us now. And by faith, we may live in that grace. Do you? Stand with me, please, in closing prayer.